You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
A Motorsport Podcast Network production.
Hey everyone, great to have you with me. Aaron Noonan here. It is another week. It is another episode of the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Castrol. Now, last time on the pod, we covered Phil Keed's amazing career in rallying with Rally Art, Subaru World Rally and Pro Drive. But by the end of part one, he'd made the call to come back to Australia, and that's where we pick up the story for this part two. Now, this ep's packed full of his time with supercars, from Team Brock, which became PWR Racing, well, really, it was the same team with the new logo, moving to Ford Performance Racing, moving to DJR Team Penske, and a couple of stints along the way at Brad Jones Racing, including being at the Albury team during the same time as the late, great Jason Richards. So enjoy this. It's Phil Keed on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Castrol. So you became a V8 supercar engineer for 2003. So this was, we should paint the picture on where the world was at this point. So the Holden Racing team was actually in huge turmoil because Tom Walkinshaw had collapsed in the UK with Arrows and all of his associated entities. The Kmart team was here as well. That was kind of part of that. And then you had this third entity that was Keys Wheel, Paul Wheel. It was Team Brock officially. It was the banner that Peter Brock had run a team under with Rod Nash and Ronnie Harrop the year before, but in essence, he was a figurehead, it was a brand, and it was the Wheels team. So how did you come to become Jason Bright's engineer at that team? What was the path that, I mean, it's one thing to decide that you're going to leave the UK and leave the Pro Drive stuff, but did you leave for that job, or did you leave and then find that job, or it found you? How did the whole process come to
be? Well, it was funny. Actually, the other thing was Possum, who had a fantastic relationship through all of working with him. He was looking at doing some WRC stuff in Group N, and so actually probably the first thought about anything, he'd offered for me to go to Pukekohe and work with them, looking at his stuff, his big program that he had for the next year. And, yeah, I thought really, really hard about that, probably most because I just really loved working with him and his team, you know, the fantastic guys. But I guess through that whole process, you know, I just sort of thought, convinced myself that I really needed to be back in Australia. And so it drove that. It wasn't that I knew where I was going, although I think supercars was the clearest sort of path at that point. I was really, you know, I'd liked tarmac rallying. I had never done any circuit racing whatsoever. So, you know, I was very interested in that. And through that time, ironically, ProDrive ended up setting up a race team in 03, but they weren't very advanced in any of that process at the end of 02. So, yeah, I think Bondi had introduced me to Howard Marsden, and Ford had some things going. But I thought, you know, probably the best thing was that, you know, I did have a contact. Someone introduced me to Keys, and I spoke to him at Bathurst that year. But really the link was to HRT. I really wanted, you know, I'd really love that large, well-organized company in ProDrive, and I realized I really wanted to go back to who was doing the best job in Australia, to be honest. So even though it was only a loose connection, I went with the PWR option, although I didn't realize how small the team was at that point, went with that option because of the strong links to HRT.
I vividly remember meeting you in early 03 in that Team Brock workshop, which was on the Clayton Business Park where the Holden Racing Team had its base, Kmart had its base, albeit slightly smaller. I do remember the Team Brock base being very, very squishy. It was very, very small. It was a little team that probably no one quite understood that at the time from the outside.
No. I mean, they were assembling the team as I arrived. They'd taken over two cars from HRT. They were fast cars as they were, but it's very different taking them over and then having to run them. They had myself, Pete Smith, who was a sort of a stalwart from back in the day and had a little bit of time off. Ty Anderson, who was another, still see Ty around, another long-term motorsport guy. So he'd come across from HRT as well. Really only four mechanics, I think. Oh, and Barry Ryan actually was there as well at the same time. Yeah, that's right. So Pete Smith, that wasn't involved at that time. Barry Ryan was, and he'd come across there. It was just a shed, not particularly insulated or ventilated shed, and then there was a porter cabin inside the shed, which had a little bit of, just had power and a few desks. It wasn't a toilet. It wasn't running water inside. There was a tap outside the back door, and then I think we had to go up to Kmart to use the bathroom. It was incredibly rustic and tiny team. I remember Bathurst 03, I was the only one left in the garage. Everyone, including the engine guy, were out there doing something on the pit stop. We had to borrow people to have a full pit crew for the two cars. So it's not never such a bad thing. It was real camaraderie there. Everyone worked really, really hard in that period.
It was kind of, Phil, the little team that could, because you didn't have the newer model car that was HRT, so you had some of their older cars, which was still, nothing wrong with them. They were still a good car, because I remember that they bowled out at the Grand Prix and everyone took a double take because you had better electrical on the cars, which was the Briggs team sponsor with the Ford team at the time. So that one got everyone's attention. And then if my memory serves, I think Bridie rolled out and won at Albert Park at the non-championship event. So the thing's off to a storming start. I think it was pole at the Adelaide 500 as well. So for the little team with all the hand-me-down stuff, you actually bowled out straight away at the front.
I think the win might have been 04 at GP, but definitely we did really quite well. The better electrical, I can't remember it. I actually wondered where the Keys had it first and it went across to Briggs. I'm not sure, but perhaps Keys took it first because I hadn't, obviously hadn't been around to know. I didn't know who Briggs were at that stage. But, yeah, it was, I think, some really unique characters there. I mean, Peter Brock being involved as well, obviously, but Keys, who at the time, I wasn't sure what to make of him, but history's showing that he's an incredibly effective, ambitious, just a doer. One of those sort of guys. Bridie is, you could do podcasts on Bridie. He's unique and also has that same mentality and mindset where they're really not bothered by the status quo or what should happen. They're one of those guys that Bridie can be last and we'll get pole tomorrow. Often there's some basis to it. I mean, he'll still tell you if you're going to be last tomorrow as well. But yeah, it was just a really unique, a really unique sort of merging of some people there. But obviously, you got to mention that they weren't 03. They weren't old cars by any stretch. They were, I think race winners and great motors. Really, we had. We still stand alone. There wasn't, we weren't working like a direct team every round, but it was really good help and crossover with the guys up at HRT, Krusty and Matt Crawford and Sweno and all those guys actually, Stretch and all of them.
What clicked between you and Jason Bright? You worked together for so many years at a couple of different teams beyond the Team Brock PWR thing, but why did you guys click so quickly? Because clearly you got along really well, you really understood one another, but what was the thing that clicked that together?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think we're both both quite similar characters in some ways, and I sort of touched on with the Tommy stuff. I mean, both quite happy, sort of speculating and wondering, and sort of working through conceptualizing ideas, possibly sometimes too much or to our detriment. But there was that being similar at that time was, I think, really an advantage. I came in with, I was experienced and I had lots of ideas and could do things, but I knew nothing about motorsport. I mean, literally not a thing. I remember we did a test day and I didn't know if it was good or bad. I didn't know what a lap time was at Winton. We then went to Phillip Island, I think was the first round, and I think we nearly won it, but then Bridie had a crash with, I can't even remember.
Ambrose.
And other than that, we were on a really great strategy. I think, really good strategy. I think Barry or someone had just knew what to do anyway. And so we, through almost none of my doing. But, here we were about to win that race. So me having no experience was actually really handy with someone like Bridie who was, a real scholar of motorsport and driving in general and sort of quite ahead of his time in some ways. So I think that also helped because you didn't have this sort of butting of heads or a sort of a sense of, no, we go this way, or even the normal demarcation of that's my bit, this is your bit, wasn't a problem for years in a way. So I think we just really enjoyed working together.
It was a 2-year period at what became PWR Racing the following year. It was always PWR behind the scenes, but it was Team Brock with the banner for that first year. The next year you got the VY Commodores, but still with the 18-degree engines. And there were some dominant performers. Like Perth, you guys won the round, back in the days of a round win rather than just the individual race win. So you contended for the championship both years in a row. But there's a couple of things that happened along the way. I mean, the first year you couldn't go and test because of the way that the grouping was with HRT and the ownership. You were basically parked up for the bulk of that year until I think it was about the Enduros when you could actually go and do a test day, which seems crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we couldn't test, as I recall. And, that was possibly more of a problem because Bridie also, his real desire was to do it his way, do it a different way. And so we were also trying to take the cars a bit away from the sort of the comfort zone because Jason didn't feel like it suited him as much. So, yeah, that was a difficult year. I do remember in the 04, I think the Grand Prix was where we rolled out and were just, it was one of those sort of conditions that really suited Jason and our car. And he was, he won it by a mile from what I remember. And that year went very, very well. It's one of those years where I'd love to have had it recur with a little bit more experience in some areas. I think we were right in the hunt all the way down to, the last round. I think Bridie had a bad crash at Gold Coast, which I think probably hurt the most because it just flattened that car and we had to go back to the older chassis, which was a not built from scratch. It had had the front chopped off it and changed over to the wishbone front end. And, you can't make excuses the way it worked. But, we were really, really in a strong position the whole year, sort of just dawning on us what was happening. People at Stoney's and other places said at the time that they considered us really strong rivals, which I was sort of surprised about. But when you look back, it was only my second year in supercars, so I sort of thought that happens all the time. But it was a really strong, really strong year, really exciting in that little team. And some of my most satisfying thing because we still just had a tiny little crew. It's good.
It was, 2004, it's amazing to think it's 20 years ago, but they were largely, and I think a lot of our listeners will remember, the white Commodore with the fluoro orange, so it really stood out. There weren't any cars that kind of looked like that before or since, but one of the things I wanted to, and you don't have to bite here, you don't have to engage if you don't feel it's necessary, but one of the things that stood out when I looked back on that year apart from the on-track stuff, was that there was a story that there was alleged sabotage at Oran Park to Jason Bright's car with, I think it was it bolts in the engine or something similar? Was that ever proven? Was there ever a theory on what happened there? Was it something that, was it more than made out than it was? What's your recollection of all that? Because I'm intrigued by that story because it got a lot of coverage at the time.
It did get a lot of coverage at the time. And, I mean, that was in that era of the Oran Park garages and it's all, you know, open above and below. I wasn't involved in discovering the problem, and obviously the motor died, so that was quite clear. No, my opinion at the time and still my private opinion is that I don't think I can't see why anybody would bother or why. I think bolts that weren't supposed to be there were there. A lot of water under the bridge. I can't remember any of the details. I just remember, you know, I just wanted to press on. I didn't really how they got there. I didn't particularly think it was sabotage. It could have been, and I could be wrong, but I remember just wanting to press on, and then it became a really big thing, and kind of I felt like for me it was attention onto the wrong things. I can't even remember Bridie's personal preference. Or thoughts on the whole thing. I think I was. Felt like I was possibly a little bit on my own in that belief, so I sort of was pretty quiet about it and just tried to press on. But yeah, it was a very big thing, and I have no strong insight there apart from that leaning.
It got a lot of headlines. I do remember. I mean, it's 20 years ago, but I remember it big time at Oran Park. So let's skip along here because the 2 years ends. So there's change. You end up going to work for ProDrive's team, which is Ford Performance Racing. Bridie goes there as well, but it's kind of not the plan because he was setting up the Britec team, his own team, but part of the way that the deal worked with Ford and was that he was going to go off and drive the Cat car for a couple of years before he got to his own team. So did you move as a couple, or did he make a move and you made a move and you ended up at the same place?
I mean, you know, whatever everyone says in these types of things, and they happen all the time. I mean, it was neither, but it definitely wasn't completely separate. I think the approach to me came almost even before to Bridie, because Nick Fry, who was, you know, I knew from ProDrive, he'd managed the Subaru World Rally team for a bit. He approached me directly, and, you know, wanted to talk about it. I don't know. I think I might have suggested Bridie, but Bridie at that point was already thinking about his own race team, you know, so that wasn't, I didn't really think of that as a particular conflict with Keys. Although, you know, it stirred up an awful lot of ill feeling, the whole thing. I think Bridie going there definitely made me more, or the fact that he, you know, started to look like he was going there, it made me much look at the whole thing a lot more seriously. My preference would have been, to be honest though, to stay at PWR for one more year, because I felt that 04 had been such a strong year, and you know, you can't just pick up, I knew enough about motorsport to know that you can't just pick up somewhere else straight away. And I thought we'd invested a lot of time and could sort of reap some rewards the next year, but Bridie was already doing his own things anyway, you know, so that really wasn't an option. And so, yeah, I guess the FPR thing, I was excited about rejoining ProDrive. I didn't realize, you know, it was really a lot of work that next couple of years. I didn't really realize or think through it. So no, I'd say more a package thing, but, you know, completely separate. There's never any of these contracts where you're a package with a driver or anything like that.
Yeah. It's one of the things that 05 period, and we covered it a fair bit last year in the Tickford Racing history book that we did on the history of all the cars, which you were a big help in, and we thank you for getting involved and sharing some of the insight. It's all in the book, which is available through the V8 Sleuth Superstore now. Nice plug. You see how I managed to just weave that in there? superstore.v8sleuth.com.au. But basically, Tim Edwards has told us on many occasions when he lobbed in there in 2005, it was a bit of a shit show. Did you have any idea of what you were walking into there? Because as you said, it took a couple of years to get the wheels really rolling and get that team up and contending.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was pretty full on. As it says in the book, you know, mainly through a lot of, it's fairly chosen upheaval. I mean, Pro Drive were approaching that in Pro Drive way of, let's do everything the best way we possibly can. JR had done, you know, really a lot of work. And I think it was all really good, groundbreaking work, but just really quite far behind. We'd probably bitten off a little bit more than we could chew for that year and had no real options with the current cars. I think they'd been sold to Bridie, ironically.
To Bridie.
So really there was no way out. It was the new cars or bust, and they were, you know, just everything different on them. Huge manufacturing things to sort of work through. Lots of new people. JR, Dave Ward, I think the team manager, he stepped away. JR also stepped away sort of through that Christmas period. And I remember DR ringing me at one point going, what is going on? You know, I think he hadn't, you know, it was all very new with the Pro Drive thing too. So it was only really an influence in terms of complicating things rather than, you know, as in with lots of new ideas and injection of cash, but not really getting it, all the structure and leadership right and everything else. I remember going and seeing Tim and showing him around the workshop and everything. And at that time I was sort of stuck, I guess, in the interim, trying to look after more of the leadership stuff and, not comfortable at all in any of that way. I'm not really that comfortable being a big people manager across all different levels, if you know what I mean. It's not my happy space. So I remember, tremendous relief when Tim arrived. Really a lot of work to do. Tremendous core of people there, though, as there still are now, which is often the way. And but just needed sort of to, I guess, you know, people to sort of stick up for everybody there.
History shows that the path was found, that things went in the right direction. So 06, obviously there was that win at the Sandown 500 where Bridie held off Rick Kelly at the end, and Mark Winterbottom had come along into the team at that point. And then Richo replaced Bridie when he headed off to Britec, and you worked with Richo. So there were some great periods there of success, speed. FPR became a player in that time, sort of 06, 07.
Yeah, it did. And I felt proud amongst all everybody there that I think felt like we'd learnt quite a lot, and there's certain paths we followed that were probably a little bit different. And it grew really well. You know, my reflection on it, again, looking at my own experience and everything else in circuit racing, you'd love some of that period to have happened a little bit later when you know what you know now. You look back and there's some naivety there. It's a common thread in my career a little bit, but you look back and think, oh my gosh, you know, probably would have looked at some of those things a little bit differently. I think Tim also he'd probably admit too, he was learning the landscape. I mean, he'd come from F1 at the highest level, but learning the supercars landscape is different again. So my only slight reflection, and it's probably I reflect it more on myself than anybody else, because I assumed sort of that leadership of the engineering group that, you know, I think we had enough of the good people there and we didn't quite execute. You know, we sort of missed out on one Bathurst. We weren't quite there. We're fast, but not there in the right way in some of the other years, 06, 08. 07 as well. And, So the championship with Frosty, I felt like I think there's loads of factors, but just didn't quite get there, you know. So it was a tremendous rise, and you can look at that and say, well, you really went from sort of one spot to, you know, really quite successful, but everything's measured in how far you get, you know. And so I still look back on that and thinking, what else could I have done? You know, I think, again, possibly with Bridie, 2-year program's never enough. You know, one more year, I felt 07 would have been, as it turned out, to be quite strong in the end. You know, it's never good at swapping people, although we're very lucky to get Richo on board as well. You know, he then contributed massively to everything there.
There's something I think you spoke about in the book, and it was a comparison, and I think it might have been a discussion with Ludo Lacroix from his time at Triple Eight, where, I mean, they were the Bathurst experts. They nailed 3 wins in a row. They got a championship with Jamie. And he talked about having, I think, and you can get it right here, but he was talking about having a car that was applicable to situations, and it was malleable. It was about being the car for all seasons, where potentially you guys went down more of a make it perfect, and if you do that on the day, it's going to be an absolute weapon, but you're not going to get as many of those days where you are the weapon of all the cars. Is in the crux of what the comment was, it was around that style of thing that in hindsight, when you look back on that period, you probably need to play the game a little bit differently to get that bigger picture success.
Yeah, and look, obviously, it's also really tangled up with the drivers that you have or grow and that era. But definitely, I think we started from a basis of the way Bridie liked to drive the car and tune the car, and then to some extent, without being able to control it, I think I learnt some of my craft that way. So you sort of end up down certain paths, and it's, you know, it's a car that probably exploits higher grip ability to do certain things. It exploits that better in some ways. And so you have these tremendously good performances. But, you know, when you look at, I guess, it's setup direction, it comes down to the way you homologate aero and all kinds of things, I guess. It's a path. But the path 888 pioneered is definitely something. And nobody at 888 will have, you know, a lot of this ends up being something you circle back and explain what it is after. There's not a whiteboard going, we're going this way with the car. You know, it's often led by one particular driver, or you just end up there. And then you look back and look at why it's strong or why it isn't strong. So with the benefit of hindsight, I'd say that's something that you can look at and, you know, borrow Ludo's words, it's sort of a championship car. Is one that you probably can dig a result out when the grip all goes, the sun comes out, or, you know, you're having a bad weekend. Our car, probably a little bit more knife edgy. When it was on, it was incredibly fast. Took a little bit of massaging, and from the engineering side, possibly more than the driver side, to make it really sing. And, you know, especially in the more modern era, the drivers, I always have done an awful lot, but, you know, a car that the driver can approach and do a lot with on any given day, any given lap session, that's something that probably leaves you in a better spot.
Mm. That period for you of FPR and Pro Drive, from my memory, so there was 2 years with Bridie, there was 2 years with Richo, there was a single year with Mark Winterbottom when the FG came on board in 2009, and then you headed off to Brad Jones Racing, which is the next chapter of your V8 period. So there wasn't that big chunk of time in 5 years where you got 3 or 4 years with a driver. There was something changing, whether it was the driver changing, the model of car changed. You never, you know, there was a little pattern here where you just never got the block of time you needed with the elements that were all clearly good elements like you had at PWR. It kept just changing along the way and not quite having it for long enough.
Yeah, that's true. That's true for sure. But then you can always, I guess, do a bit to engineer those things yourself, those situations. The complication for me, you know, I guess it was a really big learning experience for me, because I'd switched from, I mean, at PWR, I guess, I was the, you know, sort of in charge of engineering at the team. But it was such a small team. We just worked together as a little group. And so for me, that was one of the attractions at FPR was the ability to sort of grow some leadership abilities and that sort of thing. It seems like a natural progression. JR leaving, you know, probably made that I ended up elevated higher than I'd expected or wanted, I guess. But, you know, you walk into that. So I guess as well as engineering a car, I was trying to take the leadership aspects as well I learned a lot about myself, and you know, I think that probably played a bigger part, the fact that I was trying to balance out both things at once. I think through that time, you know, I think there's ways you can manage leadership. You know, perhaps you have somebody else that does more of some of the things, a separate design guy, you know, mirrors a little bit more what we had at HRT, where they did a lot of the car, and we, you know, I did, I guess, more the race engineering application of it and the running of the car. I would say that's probably as big or bigger factor, and no real excuses. I think I didn't do, you know, my own reflection, I didn't do as good a job as I could have in some areas. I'm really proud of what we did, but you sort of look back and think, you know, you sort of sometimes need somebody to say, hey, this is what we need. We need another person in here, or we need to share it. Campbell did come on board, which I think had tremendous opportunity. But I felt like I really, by the end of that 6 years, I really questioned whether I was contributing positively or negatively to the whole thing, and really questioning myself, and just felt I needed to make a change from the group, you know, and from that whole thing. So rightly or wrongly, off I went to BJR.
And that change led you up the Hume to Albury on the border to join Brad Jones Racing. And, of course, by this stage, Jason Bright is there. So there's a reunification here again of you two. Did you feel like you had unfinished business together as a duo?
I think so. It was never spoken of. I guess we always felt pretty confident working together. He was just somebody that I felt always supported by as the engineer, you know, with the driver, and so we had good teamwork, and that then frees you up to do good work, I think, when you've got that with a driver. So I think it was more that it was environmental more than to prove a point. I feel like in my career, you know, most people would go mad anyway if you look back any other way. But for me, the growth opportunities, learning and things are a bigger, and experiences are a bigger factor for me than ticking boxes. I would like to have ticked more. For me, I've always been motivated by growth and learning.
So BJR is a big block of time here. I think it was, 2010 through to 2015 off the top of my head. So a bit of time again with Jason Bright, and then more time spent with Fabian Coulthard, particularly once the Car of the Future era got rolling as well, which was 2013 onwards. But I just want to focus in on that period at BJR where Jason, I mean, you've spoken about JR, and that was John Russell, we should point out to listeners at Ford Performance Racing. So the JR in Albury that I want to talk about is Jason Richards, of course, who he was there when you arrived, and later in 2010 came the news that he was ill. An amazing era of support that the pit lane did. But take me inside that team, because one of the things I've always loved about Brad and Kim's place, or Brad's place as it is now, it always had the vibe of a family team, not just because it was a family that owned it and ran it. You had a lot of people, and I guess you and your family were the same, who had moved to come and join the team, had moved away from families and support networks, but came to sort of country New South Wales. And for a lot of people, they might go, oh, there's nothing there. I'm in the middle of nowhere. But it seemed to really work for a lot of people. And the team was a team away from the racetrack. It was, you know, everyone was friends with everyone, and there was, you know, life friendships, not just race team relationships, that helped that team through a really difficult time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Firstly, focusing on JR, he was somebody, Bright and I'd always sort of had the odd chat at the back of the pit lane or whatever with he and Wall, actually, and really liked both those guys. Jason Richards, just a real guy, like just a good human, honest, incredibly fast, never was able to, or had the luck to demonstrate what he's really capable of. And obviously his career, I think, was, for me, it was just really ramping up at the point when he got sick. But, you know, just the loveliest person. And one of those drivers that they don't take from the team, they contribute to the team. And so that, yeah, that environment there, they already, you know, the leadership of Brad and Kim at that time, and the guys that were there, it was one of those teams that had grown rather than, you know, being recruited. So tremendous team spirit, really good leadership, lovely team. And then, you know, I think JR and Bridie really hit it off and really found ways to work together, reinforce each other. They became great mates, and they really contributed, and JR especially, to growing that team into this, you know, into what it was, along with obviously Brad and Kim and everybody else. So Jason, yeah, that was, you know, just amazing with Jason. It was only 1 year that I sort of got to really know him, got to know him really well, along with everybody else in the team. Yeah, and I think everybody there felt like, and still feels to some extent, that they're sort of carrying on some of his legacy, I think, which is nice.
Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online, thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.
I vividly remember 2011 when Bridie won in Perth, which was kind of the day of all parts for BJR, the same day that Carl Reindler had that massive accident on the grid when the Steve Owen drilled him from behind and the thing went up in flames. I picked a good one to call that weekend, actually. I think Matty White was away doing the royal wedding from or something. I can't even remember why I was commentating that weekend. And then Bridie goes and wins. And I think Bugs was on the podium in the same race. It was a 1-3, but that was BJR's first championship supercars race win. They'd won at the Grand Prix with the Falcons in the wet a few years earlier, but that was a real breakthrough. Is that one of your favourite wins of your V8 supercar career?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's a few, but that one, you know, it was huge. And we'd been, you know, working up to it, and it's hard when you haven't won anything at a particular team and you feel like you can't even see how it's going to occur, you know, but it had just been growing and growing, and it was, yeah, everybody was just pinching themselves. I mean, the speed was good, but, you know, just everyone pinching themselves. It was amazing. Very typical Bridie. I think he was got a bit jack of the strategy in the end, but he had to pass everyone sort of right at the end. You know, it was one of those ones where we sort of spaced it out, but, you know, you give up track position by stopping one more time or whatever it was. But, you know, a real one of those sorts of, you know, what sort of come to be a BJR sort of strategy where it's like probably a little bit more difficult but pretty exciting. Bridie's always in for those sorts of things. And, yeah, and then coupled with the green car, you know, burning in front of us, we had to, you know, regroup, do the restarts on the mechanics that sort of almost hurt themselves, and we're over the fence helping themselves, you know. It's yeah, so hell of a day. And Bugs up to third. Also, it was a real, absolutely a team effort, you know, in the engineering, and all of the boys, or the boys always are, you know, in for everybody there. But the engineering, I think we'd all really thought through everything and had a sort of a real direction. We're following it as a group, all of us. I felt like we're all on the same page really well. And so then, you know, first and a third, and it felt like it was everybody's efforts culminating there, you know, and that was probably the best thing.
There was another win later that year on the home track too at Winton, where Bridie got another win. So wasn't at the point of a championship contention sort of season, but to grab some wins at that period where we were coming to the end of the blueprint era, the kind of the powerful teams had kind of the advantage. We saw that the next year because FPR and Triple Eight won every race between them. But there was still the chance on the day at Gary Rogers Motorsport, BJR, some of those other teams were able to jump up there and grab a trophy. So was just a nice little era there for that team that was going through such a rough time away from the track with JR's health. And obviously he passed away at the end of 11 in mid-December.
Well, I think, yeah, Winton, I think, was actually the next round. So, yeah, that was it was a really, really exciting time and you know, just, yeah, such a shame that we didn't have, you know, JR in the car as well. But he was there. He came down to Winton and was sort of, you know, out there. And, I mean, which was really lovely.
One of the coolest memories, I think they threw him on the podium there with Bridie. So the two Jasons had a cool moment on the podium there and slammed some of that champagne around on I don't think it was cold afternoon, but by that stage of the day, a chilled champagne at Winton on a Sunday afternoon is probably a little bit icy cool. But hey, tell me too, so it was 2012, which was the last year of the blueprint cars before we went to Car of the Future. Was that the year that you swapped to engineer Fabian? What happened there? What was the story behind the swap? Was it a change as good as a holiday?
Probably, although it was a little bit more. I think, you know, Brad was probably tearing his hair out by that stage because, I don't know, I guess Bridie and I, you know, I think we'd probably both still say we were great mates, but working together, we just sort of hit a little bit of a used-by date and there was some conflict and just we weren't sort of aligning on direction, I guess it was.
You didn't quite go full Tommy Mackinnon on one another. The glass salt shaker didn't get thrown in the transporter.
Nothing was thrown.
Just clarify.
yeah, and so it just started not working more than it worked. And to be honest, I think the catalyst was actually probably around that Perth and Winton time and we just sort of maybe weren't quite aligned on some of the direction there. Not sure what the reason was, but these things sort of happen. And I think we both maintained respect of each other through that. But by the end of that, you know, I don't know if it was possibly even the beginning of 12. And I don't know if it was even the start, but I think we'd done a round at 2012 and swapped from memory. I think it was just hit a point. And Brad's really good with these things and he's really good at keeping things working, but also at saying that this is probably just not working here, boys, and we'll swap around. So Andrew Edwards and Wall, who are a sort of a duo at that stage, took over running Bridie. And I, with I think Paul Scales at the time, we were working with Fabian. So yeah, that was quite a big change. I remember it was like a little divorce. There were, you know, tire guy went this, and the car stayed with the drive. It was springs. Who gets which springs? You know, at that time, everyone knew which spring just about by name. The damper sets. You know, it was all came up for a lot of discussion when we did the swap. But you know, I think Fabian and Bridie didn't probably work together in the same way that Bridie and Jason Richards did. But I think that little union of Jason Richards and Bridie was unique. You don't see it very often when there's that much genuine sort of enjoyment working together. I think it was just a more typical pair of driver relationship with Fab and Bridie.
The Car of the Future era was a reset for everybody in the pit lane, and you guys, as when we look back at history, rolled out really well because both Bridie and Fabian were up the front and winning races. I think Fabian had his first wins down in Tassie that year as well. So you guys worked together for what, the best part of 3.5 odd years, and then at BJ's, and then went on and worked together at DJ Team Penske. How did you and Fabian thing evolve? Because you seemed to click as well as you had with Bridie previously, and the results showed that for the next year or two.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a very different sort of relationship. But Fabian's probably more back to, you know, he I'd say doesn't enjoy the speculative stuff as much as Bridie did. And so I felt like, you know, we had to, it was a very different basis how it worked, and I felt like I learned a bit, I guess, working with Fabian. It took a little while to get started and work out what we were doing, where we were going. But once it was working, I think we had quite a good thing going. I think the team at BJR again, you know, we were really good at finding strengths of different people and who worked where and trying to deliver the glory of it through to everybody that contributed. It was a real team effort. I felt like we had some really good success. I thought that was an era with Fabian. I think, you know, we had a couple of seasons where he'd be in the lead of the championship or very close, you know, around Townsville time or whatever. We didn't put full seasons together, but we had some really, really good results. We were getting better and growing. So for me, the catalyst was 13, and I think we managed to get off to a really good fly. We did some really good stuff over that Christmas and rolled out in some areas sort of almost ahead. And then that, as it does, it carried on, and I felt like we kept growing quite well.
So I think it was a period where he won his first championship races at Simmons. I remember there was a good win in Adelaide at the start of one of the years. It might have been 15 or 14. I can't remember off the top of my head. But there was enough sugar, enough success there to always stay motivated, stay in the game. There was results flowing on occasion. So why go to DJR Team Penske? And it's another one where you and driver end up at the same place. And I'm not trying to slot you here on you being a package, because we've already chatted about that with Bridie and just how things had worked out. But I went back and Googled a little bit. So was the potential to maybe do something in North America more the driving factor to connect through to the Penske thing and Fabian ends up there as well? What was the whole scenario there, and how did it go down with Bradley? Because I'm guessing, you know, you guys have got a thing going and then it's not going and he's got a change to make.
Yeah, and you know, none of these things are very easy, not even very easy to sort of resolve back later. You know, Brad, I think I've always found him, you know, one of the best people I've ever worked for. He's a great leader, is honest and open and always very, very kind to me, and you know, he's always helped me grow, I think, through my career. He's a really tremendous figure. And again, you know, I think the connection to Penske came, I think, through Fabian, but they contacted me. But to be honest, that wasn't the catalyst. I mean, I'd had offers from, yeah, I think AAA a couple of times, or from Ludo anyway, and I'd been thinking about it. I don't. It's one of those times I wish I'd stayed. But then you never know. I think Andrew Edwards would have been through the same thing more recently. You just never know what else there is. Have I stagnated? It's never really the team. It's what, you know, can I learn more? Can I grow? Is, you know, I guess the chance to be involved in a really large organization again, and the, you know, the connection to whatever technical things they had, the chance possibly that it, you know, things went well, that it might lead to other overseas things. It was another factor. I'm not really explaining it very well, and there isn't really an explanation. It was BJR at that era up to 15 was probably our family's favourite era of living. It was a just really lovely environment. We loved life there. I loved working at BJR, and yet I set off. So I guess it's, you know, it was very difficult telling Brad. And it was me, not the team. There wasn't anything I could really put my finger on, except perhaps things had become a little bit comfortable for myself. And it's hard to explain that one, but yeah, I think it was more, you know, I didn't want to stagnate, and just had a sense of that. And, you know, I question it sometimes whether it was the right move.
This is what life's about, though, and it's been a theme on this podcast for 5 years that I've talked to people, because there's the door that's left unopened or unwalked through is a door that you will always wonder about in life. So whether it's right, wrong, or indifferent, if you don't open the door, or you don't peek through it or walk through it, then there's always going to be something to regret, whether you regret walking through it, or you regret not opening it, or you regret not walking through it. So there's that's just life, isn't it? That's just the scenario, and no one knows what's the next bit. You can only play with the ball that's in your hand at the time, and how you're feeling and what you're thinking, and whatever happens after that happens.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. And you know, I learned an awful lot about myself and lots of things. You know, moving up to DJR, the interaction with Penske was interesting, and you know, you never look back, and it's been a really positive experience, the whole thing. But yeah, no, there just wasn't any great reason to leave BJR either.
So you end up actually being with Fabian again, and you guys actually got DJR Team Penske its first win, didn't you, down in, was it Tassie, at Simmons Plains in 2017, the second year. So that was the year where the rocket started to take off of the Penske supercar team.
Yeah, 16 was a, I mean, you know, there's sort of some new, you know, half the team, they just expanded to two cars, which is really difficult, taking on a lot of mechanics and things like that. But 16 was a really torrid year, actually. FPR was still going quite well with those FGs, FGX. There was so much hard work had gone on. It was a good car. You know, there was Nick Hughes and all those guys had done so much hard work, and we just couldn't really deliver. 16 was, you know, such a low point, and felt really demoralizing. But I think, you know, definitely 17, Ludo came on board, Scotty Mack came on board. You know, those two absolutely changed things. But, you know, I think there was also that one of those things where an overnight success was a lot of the work. I mean, prior to when I got there in 16, so much good work had been done, and it was a really nice car. Yeah, so it all started to happen at the beginning of 17.
Looking back at that period, both when you were there and then when you weren't there in the couple of years after, was it a case of, I feel like Fabian's been maligned over the years, but he just came up against what we've come to know as McLaughlin's going to be one of the all-time greats for what he did in supercars. He's gone on to become a winner in IndyCar. Do you think it's probably unfairly paints Fabian when people will inevitably look at X championships to Y or X race wins to Y or poles or whatever the metric of performance is, that, you know, anyone who came up against Scott McLaughlin at the time was, you know, up against what we now know is a guy who's world class.
I mean, yeah, you never know at the time, as you said. And I mean, that was one of my proudest years. And Fabian, I think, finished third. He was leading the championship with two rounds to go. Granted, Scott had a bit of a bumpy start to that season, but, you know, I was really, really proud of that. And I think it was a really good performance, you know, by Fabian. Really good. And I think he does deserve to be held up there. I mean, it's the achievements he had are very strong. A lot of people finish their career as a really good race driver and they haven't won any races or maybe won. So it was an interesting one. Definitely a year I felt very, very proud of, though, in the way it worked. We won the team's championship and Fabian was third in the drivers as well.
Why did you not stay at DJR Team Penske? I get the impression that was supposed to be going for longer than it did. What, did it just not work out? Did it just not click for you?
Yeah, I mean, I had a 3-year contract there, and 17 was the second year of it. I think there's never any one factor. I loved working with a lot of the guys there. I think there was an interaction with, you know, with Ludo. I think we're really good mates, actually. We were up till that point. Always really loved sailing and that kind of thing. And actually now we hang out quite a lot, mountain biking and things like that. But, I mean, something I felt like I always knew was that we probably not really suited to working together particularly well. You know, I think you just end up with these kind of engineer languages, this relationship where, you know, and I think Ludo, he's one of those mercurial sort of leaders, but often, well, not often, I mean, they're pretty unique people, but they have a fairly narrow set of people that they need around them for things to work. That was one factor. I feel like I sort of learned about myself that I wasn't really a Penske guy. clearly tremendously successful motorsport organization and everything else. But, you know, they're, I found them a little bit more about being quiet and just follow the process and we'll get there eventually. And I don't know, I'm probably more of an agitator. So I'm aware, I think my style probably may not have suited them. I think ultimately, you know, I don't really know what happened, but I just, after that year when we came, I think, third in the team's championship and Fabian third, Ryan and Ludo just, you know, took me into Ryan's office and said, look, we don't have a position for you next year. They did sort of quote, you know, teamwork and things like that, which I thought was interesting because we had won the team's championship. but this is one of those things that happens in motorsport. It's often more about the politics and everything else. I'm still really good mates with a lot of the guys I met there. Still, you know, see them a lot. And, you know, it was separate to that. It seemed more political, a little bit more, you know, but at the end of the day, perception's reality. That's what happened. I'm not going to say it was totally unfair. I obviously just didn't have a fit or a place there. So, but, you know, it was actually a really beneficial experience because I had the severance thing was a year of gardening leave, essentially. So, you know, I was sort of reminded of a couple of clauses in the contract, non-disparagement and other things, which I took to be just disappear, you know, help it all sort of go away. And yeah, so I took the family off to Canada, my wife's from there, and we had a year living there, or close to 18 months. And, yeah, it was just an incredible experience and time of my life, which I was really, really thankful for, to be honest. It was, pretty bizarre and unique situation.
Things work out for a reason, Phil. These things happen for reasons. Sometimes you've just got to wait a bit longer to find out what they were for. So your garden... I was going to say your garden was looking very good, but you weren't here to tend to it because you were over there. But you come back, you join up with Charlie Schwerkholt with Team 18. So you're really there as, I guess, a head of engineering type role, wasn't it? And then COVID came and it kind of changed everything for everybody and you ended up back on, I think you were race engineering, Scotty Pye, weren't you, there on the DeWalt car for that period where crew sizes were chopped down and it was just the hard yards just to keep the whole thing moving.
Yeah, that was pretty tough. We had the first year was a one year operation. The first year was a one car operation, and which is always really difficult. I think so that was pretty tough. And then the COVID thing, we had the original engineer that was working there, Stu, he decided to go sort of on his own way. So we had some, you know, it was growing the team and we had some staff, you know, some turnover. Then COVID came, expanded to two cars, and then it went back to having to, you know, everybody or half the team had to sort of go on ice. Some made it through and some didn't. So, yeah, it was a really tricky time. I ended up back on the car, which, to be honest, I enjoy. And I think in a small team like that, it's very difficult being a leader or a technical director or a chief engineer or whatever when there's just two or three, four engineers at the most. You know, it's sort of you're better off being involved and doing your part than telling people how to do their thing. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being back on engineering Scott Pye for those years. We had some success in that, you know, I think we grew through that period. It felt tough, felt like a tough era. We were getting kind of brained by the T8 guys in there, you know, ostensibly the same car. I believe it's the same car. I don't think there were even many secrets. It just, you know, really, I found a really great learning experience. But, you know, it was, it can be tough in that sort of time.
You went back to BJR for 2022. So, you know, the circle came around from when you'd left, what, I guess, 7 years prior. But this time around different, not in Albury. You live in Queensland. You commute to the workshop and to tests and race events. And then, of course, you've got 1 year with the old car, and now we're into the Gen 3 stuff. So do you feel, you know, the Phil Keed of now going back in and doing BJR versus the Phil Keed of when you went to BJR last time around, where have you changed? One of the themes that I'm picking up from all of this is that you've been in positions and places where being more managerial or head of a department, at your core, you're a racer. So engineering the race car and trying to make it go faster, win races, is the bit that really fulfills you and floats your boat and is what you're good at. And the other stuff, managing people and running things a bit more overall, is not perhaps the thing that really drives you as much.
Yeah, I mean, like anybody, and I think we spend half our careers learning these sorts of things. I where I wanted to go was the natural progression, which often is into leadership. I think I'm very, very comfortable with detail, and you know, actually really happy living in that little sphere. I love data, and I love the race engineering challenges. I like a lot of the technical challenges. And over time, I think I learned to be a bit better leader of people and things like that. But I also just found that although I was getting better at it, a lot of my bandwidth goes on the leadership aspects of it. And even then, I wouldn't rate myself as overly good at the direct people management. You know, I think, I can probably through more passion or the doing, I can probably inspire smaller groups and particularly engineers and things like that. But as for the real mechanics of having to just keep everybody fed and the you need to be very routine and everything else, that really isn't me. So yeah, it's probably partly things you enjoy and then partly, you know, it just suits my thing. So over the years, I've been lucky. Even at BJR, you know, I was ostensibly the senior engineer when I was there earlier, but we had Andrew Edwards there in a sort of an engineering manager role, probably doing the lion's share of the kind of organizational tasks. And I've always found that kind of an environment to work the best for me, where you've got somebody and you just have to learn to work together. It's about chasing that kind of thing, I feel, about myself. I'm really enjoying it. I do enjoy race engineering, and I'm not quite ready to let go of that yet.
We would hope not. We would hope not. There's still plenty of races to do. Does Gen 3 as an engineer, does it turn you on enough? There's so many control parts in those cars now. There's less that you can go and design, play with, test, invest brain space, financial investment in. Is there enough there to keep an engineer that needs stimulation and stuff to play with and stuff to try? Is there enough to keep you up for the challenge and up for this for X years?
Yeah, I mean, it's how many years you can keep going supercars is separate, but no, Gen 3 and you know, I mean, they've been slowly tightening the rules for years anyway. To be honest, it just changes the areas you focus on, and sometimes these sort of, you know, it's a misnomer, this sort of idea when it's a control thing. I mean, there's so many things that you can't control and so many things that can, you know, they're now interactions of legal parts or whatever it might be. For me, the detail gets narrower. I find it just about as challenging. The whole thing shifts. I think you do a little bit more and try and understand things better, or you might try and simulate some things a little bit better. No less interesting, to be honest. You know, it's just replaced design with some other types of engineering work.
All right, we've proven that one to be wrong then. We thought we'd ask that one and just get to the bottom of someone who knows what they're talking about with that stuff. The other thing too, so Bryce Fullwood, you worked with him now for a couple of years. He is the Prince of Darwin, I believe is his official title. I think that's a thing. It's official now. It's capitalized. What do we not know about Bryce Fullwood? Because there's so many young drivers in supercars who, and he's been around for a little while now with Super 2 and Walkinshaws and time with you at BJR now. But what do we not know about him? I feel like there's a bunch of these young supercar drivers that we don't know a great deal about them, and I thought you might be able to peel the layer a little bit on the Prince of Darwin.
He's a complex character, the Prince of Darwin, actually. What you don't know, I mean, I think if he's, you know, I'm sure he'll have a really successful motorsport career, but, you know, he's really, really amazing at sort of design, fabrication and those kinds of things. It's, you know, he's sort of always got a few projects on. He's got some cars that he's built or building. I mean, you know, sort of ground up restoration, custom type stuff. He's got a little workshop with a little mill, I think he's got a little CNC laser cutter machine at the moment or plasma cutter. He's forever in there under his car, tinkering away, building. I mean, but genuinely building. And it's something I don't think you'd pick about him, but I think he could probably have a career in one of these sort of, Diesel Brothers style TV shows where they sort of take something and do some crazy thing. That's definitely something you don't see about him.
Any word on whether he's got a Datsun 1600 project coming up? You might be able to assist.
He has a Datsun 1200 project.
Close enough.
Yeah, no, and it's pretty nice. It's going to be a lot nicer than my Datsun 1600, that's for sure.
Mate, before we let you go, you've worn a lot of uniforms over the year, lots of different colours, lots of different teams. I love to ask people about this on the pod because you know what we're like and I'm like. I love the history of stuff. We love where the old cars go. We love memorabilia, collectibles. Where are you on the scale of 1 to 10 from full-on hoarder to haven't kept a thing in terms of race team kit, memorabilia, collectibles, stuff from along the way?
I have a lot of team kit sort of stashed away but not being on it, and I've no idea what I'll do with it. I would say I didn't take enough photographs back in the day when cameras and photography was a thing. I have probably a sporadic sort of lot of mementos from some of the years, and I actually wish I had a few more little bibs and bobs. You know, there's the odd favorite car that I wish I had a model of. I've got a few of, you know, just nice little things drivers have given, or, you know, the sort of the winning hats and some photos from teams. But probably low on the hoarding scale, save for some team kit up in my roof.
All right, we'll make you a 2 out of 10 then on the sleuth hoarding scale. You've definitely not got past halfway with that stuff. You haven't got bits of race cars hidden in your ceiling or anything like that. So I think that's probably a good way to be, mate. Thanks so much for the chat. Thoroughly appreciate it. It's been you're over a 2-decade veteran now of V8 supercars, but between all the rallying stuff, sweeping the floors at Bondi's worked out pretty well. I think you've got to agree. All the best for the rest of this year, and we'll see you at the track soon.
Thanks, mate. See you again soon.
So good to catch up with Phil Keed, a chat that we recorded online a little while ago, but through the power of technology, we can do these things. It's quite amazing, isn't it? What a smart guy, passionate, competitive. He's a ripper. Phil Keed, if you see him at a racetrack, say g'day and ask him about Tommy Mäkinen. I hope you enjoyed this chat as much as I did recording it. I hope that the enjoyment that I have in doing these chats and bringing them to you goes through the microphone, through whatever you're listening to, and into you as well, because I love the passion that our fans and our listeners have for the sport, and I love being able to bring it to you and bring it closer to people that you otherwise might not know much about. You might know their name, you might know their face, but I hope that we put some more to it all to give you a bit more insight. Thanks for voting with your ears and listening to the Motorsport Podcast Network and this, the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Castrol. I'm Aaron Noonan. Thanks for tuning in. Send us your feedback via the V8 Sleuth website form, and I'll have another episode for you next week.
Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.